For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to a very special episode of Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we'll be celebrating the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. Sarah, Duchess of York, will share some royal reminiscences and explore her own lineage through her new historical romance, Her Heart for a Compass. Robert Kirkwood discovers some crown jewels in the RNIB library. Anjali Q. Ralph takes us on a right royal adventure as the boy at the back of the class struggles to keep a royal appointment. And Hannah Taus celebrates some of the great reads from across the Commonwealth among the 70 titles selected for the Big Jubilee Read. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Sarah, Duchess of York, first came to prominence in the world of publishing through her series of children's books about Budgie the Little Helicopter. Her success continued with her Little Red and Helping Hands series, as well as several standalone self-help titles for adults. Now she's made her first foray into the world of romantic fiction. Based on the life of one of her own ancestors, Her Heart for a Compass tells the story of Lady Margaret Montagu Douglas Scott, a Titian-haired, freckled beauty, at first lauded and then vilified by the Victorian press. And I'm delighted to say that Sarah, Duchess of York, has joined me today to tell me more.
You write in an author's note to the book that you were inspired to write it by discovering that your protagonist, Lady Margaret, was a distant ancestor. Can you introduce us to her?
Well, how exciting. Thank you so much on behalf of Lady Margaret to allow me to introduce her. Well, the interesting thing is I have always wondered why I'm very strong redhead and that I'm resilient and I keep bouncing back. And I thought, well, it must be in my DNA. So I researched my ancestors, and I found that there was a lady called Lady Margaret Cameron, who all her brothers were written about, but not Lady Margaret. So I, since she was one of my ancestors, I thought I'd give her a life that she might like. So I wrote about Lady Margaret as the lead with the red hair, and I gained a lot of strength in my own life and in understanding what it must have been like around those times when you weren't allowed to be free and to be a woman with your own voice.
And her parents were your great-great-great-grandparents, I believe?
That's correct, yes.
And her untamable red hair is rather a metaphor for her character. It, too, refuses to be tied down against its will. And it's very much symbolic of her story and present on most of the pages of the book.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Red. And for anyone listening, I think we can safely say that there is an awful lot of my character in this character in the book. It is a work of fiction. It is about a very strong redheaded woman. But, you know, there's a lot of similarities between the two of us. Let's just put it like that.
Well, she too suffers for what society might see as rebelliousness or not wanting to stay in the place assigned to her. She is supposed to marry a rather unsavoury member of the aristocracy, and she can't bear the thought of doing so. So from having been lauded as a breath of fresh, red-headed Scottish air by the Victorian press, she is vilified for, well, following the compass of her heart.
Yes, I think it is very much about the fact that I feel strongly about following how you feel, and sometimes it gets you into trouble, but it is your life. It is, yes, you can. I'm very polite and I do keep to the boundaries, but I sometimes have to follow what I believe is my path, and I think Lady Margaret did that, and she was cast out of society for following her heart. And so, you know, I knew how she felt.
One of the most striking things was how her sister Victoria is held up by her parents and the Victorian press and society in general as being the paradigm for what a good society woman should be. And this is obviously rather irksome to Margaret. And I was rather reminded of how the press treated Princess Diana and you during the 1990s.
It's really interesting you pick that up, because very few people pick that up. But there is such similarities. And, you know, if you look back now at the front pages in the 80s, you wouldn't, no one would be allowed to write what they wrote about Diana and I. You just wouldn't be allowed to. And I think that's very, very interesting. I really do.
And as the book progresses, we see Margaret realise that she doesn't need to conform to the place that society thinks that she should be boxed into. And she makes her own life. She goes into exile in Ireland and ends up writing children's books. It's very much a book about staying true to yourself, about the importance of resilience and to following your heart and your feelings. Does that reflect your own trajectory over the last 30 or so years?
I think that you learn from your experiences, don't you? And you glean information from your own experiences. And in that, you experiment with experiences and experience with experiments. And I believe that in the course of my life, I'm 62 now, and looking back over my life, there's a lot of the feelings that I had during these last 36 years in public life, that I would feel that that is what would have happened to Lady Margaret. So this book is very much line by line. It is a vision of mine. It's from my heart with a great sense of feeling, because I could relate to a lot of what Lady Margaret went through. And it is brilliantly supported by my fellow collaborator, Marguerite Kay. So I find I take being a first-time novelist incredibly seriously. And I am very proud that I am. This is my debut novel. That I've gained confidence from writing it. That I've managed to dare to write it. I've wanted to write it for 15 years. And so I'm really proud to be talking to you, Red, and to be discussing at real authentic depth things which no one's ever heard before, which is the similarity between the written word of Lady Margaret and my own life.
You mentioned that you have collaborated with Marguerite Kay, who is a veteran of the historical romantic fiction genre, who has written many, many books, and yet the words are definitely your own. We hear Sarah Ferguson's voice on every page. It is clearly not a ghost-written book. These are your words.
Yes, they are my words, Red, and thank you very much. And the way that Marguerite Kay is an incredible, strong Scottish lass, and she has written 60 books, I think. And so she has held my hand and guided me in how to write a novel. And that is a huge collaboration to, I think, anyone listening who wants to know if they can write, just put your hand out and ask for help and ask to be guided. With Marguerite, she helped me line by line, page by page, by really going to the depths of, she kept sort of asking me, well, how do you feel about that? And is this how you would be? And was it how it was? And I started being very intrepid about my journey into writing, into this author's journey. And then when I ended, I longed for it not to end. And I was so excited about my own character. And then, well, I've just finished book number two, which is called An Intriguing Lady. And I'm just desperate to keep going, because it's my way of escapism that I throw myself into my characters. And it's Marguerite that has really shown me how to do this. And so, yes, it's very much 100% of my words. And I'm really proud of having achieved that.
Did you find it difficult to step back into real life away from the page at the end of each day when you've been sitting down and writing?
There's no way. There's no way I wanted to. I was having so much more fun in my own imagination. I didn't want to leave my character, lovely Lady Margaret. But now I've gone into Lady Mary, my next book, and then I'm starting tomorrow my third book. I just love my writing process, and I love to I think it's my way of getting out of my own way. Sometimes our mind can play tricks, can't they? Especially after the pandemic, and we go at such speed that anyone who's listening who goes through self-doubt or self-esteem issues, you know, this is what I do. And the way I get out of it is by throwing myself out of my head and into the page.
We can really hear the sense of enjoyment and excitement in your voice, and it comes off the page, especially in the audiobook reading, which we'll talk about. The book is at 500 pages, a bit longer than your standard Mills and Boon book, and it's certainly no bodice ripper. I wondered if that was a conscious decision on your behalf to keep it so.
Yes, Red, it was very consciously done, that I wanted the first book to be a work of real literature that I was proud about, and not, as everyone said, it was going to be a bodice ripper. And I wanted it to stand alone. And it, you know, I was very proud when we hit, first time ever Mills and Boon in 100 years had hit the Sunday Times bestseller list. That's not a throwaway line, is it, Red? And for me to have got this beautiful book out, it's a huge sense of achievement for Sarah. But again, as I just said to you, Red, I live with a lot of mental pressure on myself. I am the worst judge of myself, you know. And so to actually have achieved this book through the hard work and through honouring my vision is really an achievement. And I'm so excited by it. And then on top of that, to think that people said to me, oh, why are you going with Mills and Boon? You should go with another publishing house. And I said, why not? And they didn't have any answer, because I answered them with Mills and Boon is one of the finest publishing houses that really fought for the women in World War One and Two to give them a way to escape into a different kind of thought process. Why should you just judge a book by its cover?
Well, we certainly at RNIB are remarkably glad that you did decide to be published by Mills and Boon, because as part of HarperCollins, that means that we automatically get the audiobook version donated very generously by them to our library, which makes it accessible to all readers. And I know it's very important to you that your book should be available to those of us who are print disabled.
Oh my goodness, you're very kind, Red. I was in Poland a few weeks ago, and then suddenly when Ukraine war started and poor Ukraine were left in this perilous situation, I was in Warsaw speaking to the mayor of Warsaw, and I heard that there were 28 blind children coming over the border into Katowice or nearby. And so I said, I need to go and see them. So I went and found them, and they were all brought over by this lovely couple. And the couple just literally took 28 children and just went on the run to miss the bombs. And they stayed in bunkers with no food, and he had to try and find ways of feeding them. And then they were brought for 5 days across to the borders into this place. When I got to meet them, they were singing like angels. There was a choir, they were just an amazing choir. And I went away and I said, I want to raise the money, £10,000, to get that song made into a record so we can release it to give hope to anyone out there, that not only who has been so intrepid coming across the borders from Ukraine to Poland, but also who is visually impaired. And I hope that this blind choir will really resonate to millions all over the world. And we're very close to getting it released, which is very exciting. And it's really kind of you to let me tell that story.
Oh, well, that is a wonderful story. And well, thank you very much for sharing it with us. The audiobook version is brilliantly narrated by Elle Potter, who clearly was thoroughly taken with Lady Margaret as well. And also, you have recorded the author's note. Are you a fan of audiobooks yourself? And did you have anything to do with the selection of Elle as a narrator?
Yes, very much so. The interesting thing is that my publisher, Rachel Carhan in New York, she knows my voice really well. Well, not just the tone of it, but the actual voice of the heart of it. And she thought Elle would be the one. And so I was asked if I wanted to read it. And I said, no, let a professional read it. The poor people don't need to hear my voice. But I was just really delighted that Elle had agreed to do it. It's a beautiful work. It really is a beautiful work. And I love it. Yes, I do listen to an awful lot of audiobooks because I tend to make audiobooks my friends. When I go into hotel rooms or when I'm on my own, I escape into the books and then I think they're all my friends. I'm quite bizarre like that.
In the months since their match had been arranged, he had made no attempt to do any such thing, allowing Margaret to ignore her own physical revulsion and persuade herself that she would be able to reconcile herself to marrying him. He had never tried to kiss her. If he touched her, it was merely to usher her here or there, and his hands never lingered on her. Was all that about to change? She shuddered inwardly. Was this model of propriety simply a gentleman patiently waiting until his matrimonial rites were formally endorsed? Dear heavens, even trying to imagine his lips on hers made her want to scrub her mouth with her handkerchief. Once the formal announcement was made, there would be no going back. She would be engaged to be married to a man she loathed, and who, she was utterly convinced, didn't give a damn about her. No, worse than that. The more time she spent in Killin's company, the more certain Margaret became that he actively disliked her.
Elle Potter, narrating Her Heart for a Compass, written by my guest, Sarah, Duchess of York.
You mentioned earlier that you have finished the second novel and are about to start writing the third. I hear rumours that novel number two is a bit more steamy.
Yes, I heard those rumours too. Yes, we have added, now that I've got a little more confidence from book one, we pepped it up a bit in book two. Not because we thought we had to or because we were told to, because I'm Lady Margaret's now moved on to Lady Mary, and Lady Mary's got a lot more confidence than Lady Margaret.
Did you enjoy writing it?
Oh my goodness me. I'd have so much fun writing it. The book number two, it's a bit risque and it's very sort of To Catch a Thief. You know, it's Cary Grant and probably Katharine Hepburn, you know, a bit like that. Very cheeky. This really is a romping good read.
Well, I hope you'll come back onto the show to talk about it in due course. Now, with the Jubilee coming up, we have been looking back through the RNIB library for books about previous Jubilees. And you and I were both much younger during the Silver Jubilee. And there are some wonderful reminiscences of what people were doing in 1977. Do you remember what you were doing?
1977, yes. I think I was standing at a beacon somewhere and I love the sense of street parties and I love it. I love the what puts great in Britain, and it's the people that puts great in Britain. It's the nation of Britain that has seen through two world wars, that, you know, saw everyone through the Blitz, saw the Queen was steadfast through the Blitz and steadfast now, and is just the most iconic legend of all times, and is no question about it. One of the finest people lady I've ever met in my life.
And it is remarkable, and a tribute to her, how she draws together so many diverse communities in the United Kingdom.
Yes, it is. I mean, there are no words really, are there? Martin Luther King said that. He said sometimes the symbol of words are not as fulfilling as the inaudible language of the heart.
That is a wonderful tribute to both her and what he fought so hard for. Do you have special plans for the Platinum Jubilee weekend yourself?
I wanted to do a sort of garden fete in the garden because I thought that would be really fun and sort of make it very much like an old-fashioned little stalls with cupcakes and, you know, and all of those good things and bunting and happiness. And I love to glue myself to the television because the commentators normally give me more information than anybody else.
Well, let's hope the sun shines on the Queen and on all of us over the entire long weekend. In the meantime, thank you so much for coming on to the show to discuss your wonderful debut novel. And I hope you'll come back at the end of the show to share the books of your life.
Oh, I would love that. Thank you very, very much for having me.
thanks to the generous support of her publishers, HarperCollins. Her Heart for a Compass by Sarah Ferguson is available from the RNIB Library. And the Duchess of York will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in Braille so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
You're listening to a special episode of Read On, celebrating the Platinum Jubilee of RNIB patron, Her Royal Highness Queen Elizabeth II. Still to come in this week's show, we go on a Right Royal adventure with Anjali Q. Ralph, and producer Hannah picks out some of the highlights from the big Jubilee read. But first, Robert Kirkwood has been busy in the RNIB Library.
In a way, I didn't have an apprenticeship. My father died much too young. It was all very sudden, kind of taking on and making the best job you can. It's a question of just maturing into what you're doing and accepting that here you are and it's your fate. I think continuity is very important. It is a job for life. Elizabeth II on television.
As Her Majesty the Queen celebrates, let's have a listen to some of the books about her life, available from RNIB. First, Elizabeth, a biography of Her Majesty the Queen by Sarah Bradford, read by Norma West.
Princess Elizabeth Alexandra Mary of York was just 10 years and 8 months old on Thursday the 10th of December 1936, when she realised that she would almost certainly be Queen of Great Britain. Tension had been building up over the dark December days as her mother lay ill with influenza in her third floor bedroom, and her father hurried in and out of the house, a haunted look on his face, the muscles in his cheek twitching with nerves. Outside the house, number 145 Piccadilly, silent crowds gathered waiting to hear if and when Elizabeth's father, Prince Albert, Duke of York, would succeed his older brother, King Edward VIII, Elizabeth's Uncle David, as King of Great Britain, Emperor of India, King of the Dominions of Australia, Canada, South Africa, and New Zealand, and titular head of the great British Empire on which the sun never set.
In Elizabeth, a biography of Her Majesty the Queen by Sarah Bradford, the author has uncovered unpublished archives and documents and has had access to people close to the family. This book is not only a great family saga spanning the 20th century, but also an in-depth portrait of a very private woman in her public and family life.
On a bitterly cold early February afternoon in 1952, a British Overseas Airways Corporation Argonaut aircraft taxied to a halt at London's Heathrow Airport. A reception line of members of the royal family and the British government, among them the unmistakable figure of Winston Churchill, stood waiting on the tarmac. All were dressed in black mourning for the late king. Despite the cold wind, the men were hatless in honour of their new queen. Aboard the aircraft, a slim young woman of 25, her skin lightly tanned by the African sun, looked out of the window. Behind the line of men in dark overcoats, ranged up to greet her, loomed the black bulk of the ancient royal Rolls-Royces. "Oh," she said, a momentary gleam of grim humour lighting her seriousness, "I see they've brought the hearses." She had waited to the last moment before donning a black coat and hat, as if to put off for as long as she could the moment of formal acknowledgement that her father was dead and that what private life she had had was forever over. As she stepped out to greet the members of her administration, she became an icon with a dual role. Executive woman and symbol of her country first, wife and mother second. She had accepted her destiny.
That's Norma West reading Elizabeth, a biography of Her Majesty the Queen by Sarah Bradford, available from RNIB. Also available is Diamond Queen, Elizabeth II and Her People by Andrew Marr, read by Crawford Logan.
A wide variety of experienced, shrewd politicians, civil servants and courtiers who observed the Queen's relationship with Margaret Thatcher at first hand agree. It was, long pause, pained expression, difficult. Here were two women of a similar age, though a very dissimilar background, previously strangers, conjoined during the most tumultuous and confrontational years of post-war politics. Among the most radical of the Thatcherite thinkers were some whose contempt for the old, flabby institutions of a weary country reached even to the monarchy. They, naively, tended to see the United States as a model in politics and economics, a briskly invigorating meritocracy where wealth was made, not inherited. They disliked the Queen's tolerance of left-wing dictators in the Commonwealth, and had no more patience for the easy life and unchallenged rituals of the court than they did for BBC executives or tenured academics. Ardent young men from think tanks saw Margaret as their real queen, the Boudicca modern Britain had summoned. Even older gurus of the right, such as Enoch Powell, warned that the Queen's overseas ambition was mere swollen pride. In the 1970s, the Marxist left had derided the monarchy, and she had been assaulted on punk T-shirts. The hostility of right-wing radicals in the 1980s was as serious. By then, many on the left had begun to delude themselves that, deep down, the Queen was secretly on their side. So one nation that she was really a lefty herself.
With the flair for narrative and the meticulous research that readers have come to expect, Andrew Marr turns his attention to the monarch and to the monarchy, chronicling the Queen's pivotal role at the centre of the state, which is largely hidden from the public gaze, and making a strong case for the institution itself.
Some senior Whitehall sources believe that there was an early stiffness between the Queen and Mrs. Thatcher. Several say that each of them found the choreography of having two women at the apex of British life slightly awkward, which was why they rarely appeared together. There were early and earnest discussions about which should go to which national events, including to pay their respects at disasters. Some officials recall meetings to make sure the Prime Minister was not wearing a similar outfit to the Queen. Others say no, the Queen does not notice what other people wear. Margaret Thatcher's refusal to leave with the rest of the ladies at the end of dinner caused some discussion before she came to Balmoral. Throughout her reign, the Queen's relationship with Prime Ministers had been with men, either older than herself and to be respected, or younger and to be helped by almost maternal listening. Here was someone different.
That's Crawford Logan reading from Diamond Queen, Elizabeth II and Her People, by Andrew Marr. It's available from RNIB, and also available is Elizabeth the Queen, The Life of a Modern Monarch by Sally Bedell-Smith. It's read by Rosalind Landor.
In the autumn of 2002, the Queen became embroiled in a controversy over an encounter she had had 5 years earlier with Paul Burrell, the butler to the late Princess of Wales. He was known as Diana's rock for his total devotion, if not, as it turned out, discretion. Before working for Diana, Burrell had been a footman at Buckingham Palace, and the Queen had rewarded his service by investing him with the Royal Victorian Order, one of her personal honours. She was told that he was torn up with grief over Diana's death, so when he asked for an audience at the palace, she was open-hearted enough to oblige.
Elizabeth the Queen is a close-up view of a woman we've known only from a distance, illuminating the lively personality, sense of humour and canny intelligence with which she meets the most demanding work and family obligations. A fascinating window into life at the centre of the last great monarchy.
On Thursday afternoon, December the 18th, 1997, Burrell had a lot on his mind when he arrived at her private sitting room on the first floor, overlooking the gardens. During their 90 minutes together, he spoke at length about Diana's troubles and her feelings toward Charles. He said that Diana's mother, Frances Shand Kidd, had been shredding her daughter's letters and memos during visits to Kensington Palace, and he told the Queen he had taken some of the princess's papers for safekeeping. Just one topic among many before he and the Queen parted company. 3 years later, in January 2001, acting on a tip from another former royal servant, police raided Burrell's home. They turned up more than 300 items from Diana's estate, including designer clothing, jewellery, handbags and furniture, as well as a lesser number of belongings allegedly taken from Charles and William. The former butler was charged with theft. As the investigation progressed, the Queen was briefed several times by Robin Janvrin, but she didn't mention her talk with Burrell because, as she later said, she didn't think his passing reference to safeguarding Diana's papers was relevant in the context of the charges Burrell faced. Nor, for his part, did Burrell disclose the nature of their meeting to his own lawyers because, he said, it was private.
That's Elizabeth the Queen, The Life of a Modern Monarch by Sally Beryl-Smith, read there by Rosalind Landor. There are many books on the royals available from RNIB libraries. For more information, head to www.rnib.org.uk/books.
Thanks, Robert.
Join me, Sandra Geyer, for The Music Box, which steals all the best ideas from the last 500 years from classical and modern music. With sparkly singers, instrumentalists and orchestras of all shapes and sizes, you do not want to miss The Music Box, Monday and Sunday evenings from 7, Sunday mornings from 8, only on RNIB Connect Radio.
Welcome back to this Platinum Jubilee special episode of Read On. Later, Hannah Tals will be reviewing some of the 70 titles selected by the reading agency for the Big Jubilee Read. But first, Anjali Q. Ralph is one of Britain's leading children's authors. Her multi-award-winning debut, The Boy at the Back of the Class, drew on her own experiences of working with Syrian refugees to reframe the refugee crisis through the eyes of a child. Without giving you any spoilers, I can reveal that it features a trip to Buckingham Palace. And a royal engagement also features in Anjali's sequel story, The Day We Met the Queen, which she wrote specially for World Book Day in 2020. Since then, Anjali has made her own journey to the palace, after she was awarded an MBE in the 2022 New Year's Honours for services to literature and women's rights.
Anjali, welcome back to Read On.
Hello, Red. Thank you so much. It's such an honour to be here.
Well, not at all. It's an honour to have you. I can't think of anybody I want to celebrate the Jubilee with more.
Oh, I'm wearing biscuit earrings for the occasion, so I'm all ready.
I will pour the tea then. Now, it's fair to say that the Queen plays a pretty major role both in The Boy in the Back of the Class and in The Day We Met the Queen. No clue in the title. Why did you want to write about the Queen in those two books?
Well, I wanted the Queen to be a major kind of feature, even though we don't really see her. She's such an important figure to the children in the books. And it's because when I grew up, and even now, I mean, the Queen is such a stable figurehead and she's such a presence in your life, even though you might never get to meet her, even though you might never get to shake hands with her or sit down and have tea with her. And when I was a child and definitely, you know, well into primary school and at the end of primary school, I had this belief that if you wanted to change something, you could probably approach her to try and help you to change it, because she is this really powerful figurehead. And my mum is such a huge fan of the Queen and the royal family in general. She's fascinated by them. So it's also homage to her. And I love this idea and this image of a woman who is, you know, with a crown on her head that might be able to help you in your wildest, yeah, ambitions. So yeah, she had to be in the books. Absolutely. I think a lot of children feel that way, actually, in some kind of small secret way.
Well, I think she's very much emblematic of diversity within the Commonwealth and how inclusion is key to its future.
Absolutely. And I think growing up and watching her go to different countries and do her speeches and welcome people over here as well in the UK has been, you know, it's one of those things that you see on the television all the time, you see on the news all the time. You grow up with this image of this woman, this emblematic aspect of the United Kingdom going out and greeting people from around the world. So she's very much someone who you associate with other places of the world, and particularly places you might not be able to go to at that age or whatever reason. But she's a traveller. She's a travelling emblem, which is so important for us to see. And I think that's pretty much the job of a lot of people who are representatives of anything, to go out and introduce eyes and ears and hearts and minds to peoples and countries that we might not be able to have access to.
And that accessibility that she has is also very key. She is a human being. She mm-hmm. does seem empathetic. And certainly in your second story, she's invited Ahmet and his friends to the palace. Mm-hmm. And it is only Brendan the bully who actually is preventing them from getting there.
Absolutely. And we do see not just Brendan the bully, but also another kind of bully, the political bullying that goes in tandem, sadly, with the refugee crisis. So Ahmet and his friends have these little layers they need to get through to get to the Queen. And I really enjoyed putting them in, because I think when it comes to a figure like the Queen, who is a human, who is a mother, a grandmother, and someone you probably might associate with a member of your family who's really kooky and interesting and bejeweled, you know, having these children go through certain obstacles to try and get to her, to try and meet her and have that cup of tea with her, was quite fun to write. And Brendan the bully is someone who they face at school. And am I allowed to mention the word fart bomb? Yeah, fart bombs do feature in the book, because why not? But there is also a more serious aspect of bullying that they encounter outside the Buckingham Palace gates, which is political bullying and political racisms that seem to engulf the refugee crisis. So there's two levels of bullying that they have to get through and they have to face and try and tear down in their own little very sweet ways.
Now, your observations of Buckingham Palace, both outside and inside, are very acute, and they are also fed by a bit of personal experience, I understand.
Yes. So when I was at the very tender age of 24, in my very first job, I was nominated to go to Buckingham Palace to have, you know, be part of the garden party that the Queen holds for her subjects. And it was so exciting. And I took my mum with me, and getting to not only just get through the gates and go inside and see the interior of Buckingham Palace, but get to see the Queen from just a few feet away, together with the Duke of Edinburgh at the time and Camilla, was really amazing. Amazing. We were fed the tiniest sandwiches, tiny, I mean, literally the size of your little finger. And I just remember that experience so vividly that, yeah, when I was writing The Day We Met the Queen, I want to put some little aspects of those into the story. So, yes, it has been fed by a very wonderful honour I had at a very young age.
And you have had a more recent honour as well. Many congratulations on being appointed an MBE. I'm guessing there'll be a return trip to the palace on the cards soon.
Well, I hope so. It looks like as if it might be Windsor Castle, which is also amazing, but we'll see what happens. But it's kind of blindsided me, this nomination and the award, which is just so wonderful. There is a whole story behind my accepting it, which I won't go into, but it was very much for my mother and my family that I accepted it, and it's such a deep honour. And I'll see what happens. Maybe there'll be a new adventure that's written after this second trip to Buckingham Palace, or my first trip inside Windsor Castle. We'll have to wait and see.
I want to know what kind of earrings you'll be wearing on the day, but we'll probably discuss that closer to the time.
Or something featuring a crown or purple or something to honour this year. Absolutely.
Are there any royal subjects in the book that you're writing at the moment?
Ooh, are there any royal subjects? Yes, there is. A wonderful postman features in the story that I'm writing at the moment, centering around, of course, the Royal Mail, which anyone who's read The Boy at the Back of the Class and The Day We Met the Queen will know. You know, the Royal Mail is very important and very, very royal to the people and the children that I feature in the book. So a very royal postman will be featuring in the next book.
And do you have plans for the Jubilee weekend yourself?
Yes, I do. I can't wait. So I am going to go to Norfolk to see Catherine Jenkins singing at Sandringham Castle, which is going to be amazing. I applied for the tickets ages ago and I tried to get in to see the Troop in the Colour ceremony, but I was 86,201st in the line, so I didn't get in. But it's okay. I think there'll be lots of television watching and lots of tea drinking and hopefully lots of music as well.
Well, I hope you have a fantastic time and I will very much look forward to hearing all about it when we meet up for the publication of your next book.
Thank you, Red. Have an amazing platinum, wonderful Jubilee as well.
And you too, Anjali.
Thank you.
Can you believe it? Can you believe we're going to see the Queen tomorrow in actual real life? I looked at Michael. We were standing by the bus stop waiting for Tom and Josie. Michael pushed his glasses even farther up his nose and, holding the card to the light, stared at it hard, just like shopkeepers do when they think your money isn't real. But we both knew the invitation was real. The card was so thick it wouldn't let any light through. The writing was fancy and swirly, and there was a thick blob of shiny red wax on the envelope. All those things reminded us that the actual real-life Queen of England had sent it and was expecting us to join her for tea tomorrow.
Imogen Wilde narrating The Day We Met the Queen, written by my guest Anjali Q. Ralph. Both The Boy at the Back of the Class and The Day We Met the Queen are available from the RNIB Library, where you'll find a selection of Anjali Q. Ralph's other books too.
Whether you find technology fun or frustrating, Tech Talk is here to help.
We will be discussing and demonstrating the very latest in accessible technology.
Again, accessible and portable, that just helped me tremendously.
And interviewing the people who made it.
We were really keen to make sure that the app was usable by the blind and partially sighted community.
You can hear us every Tuesday from 1 p.m. right here on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to the Duchess of York to share the books of her life, here's Read On producer Hannah Towse.
The Big Jubilee Read launched this year to celebrate the Queen's Platinum Jubilee, alongside a campaign to promote reading for pleasure. And it is quite the list, with 70 books written by Commonwealth authors dating back to 1952, the year of the Queen's coronation. With 10 books selected from each decade of Elizabeth II's reign, the titles range from Zadie Smith's White Teeth to V.S. Naipaul's A House for Mr. Biswas, from Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy to Arundhati Roy's The God of Small Things. Readers suggested the original long list, which was then cut down by a panel of librarians, booksellers and literature specialists, with the aim to engage all readers in the discovery and celebration of great books. And while there are 19 winners of the Booker Prize included, don't let that put you off. There are also some cracking and perhaps more accessible books included, though apparently Her Royal Highness would have liked to have seen Dick Francis on the list as a long-time fan of his horse racing thrillers. Read On has been fortunate enough to interview a number of the authors included, starting with the late John le Carré, who Red spoke to back in 2019. Writer of great spy novels, it is his classic Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy that made this list. If you like a world of intrigue, subterfuge and espionage, this is the perfect place to start.
Because of the mystique of espionage, which is really spun round me, I have quite easy access. So it was no problem to me when I wanted to see Russia, of course, just before the wall came down in the perestroika years. And I wanted to get into the criminal community in Russia immediately after the wall came down. And I found that really top criminals wanted to meet me, were happy to meet me, want to talk about themselves. And it's something that Graham Greene said to me, and it's very true, don't worry when you walk into a crowded room. Leave your talent behind and let them talk to you. Because actually, what people do when they meet somebody they've wanted to meet for some time or they're excited to meet, they talk about themselves. I very seldom get questioned about myself in company.
Or perhaps you're a fan of historical faction, in which case you can't go far wrong with Wolf Hall. And our very own Robert Kirkwood was lucky enough to have a chat to the author, Hilary Mantel.
Wolf Hall is a novel I've been thinking about for a long time, maybe 20-odd years. I've been thinking one of these days I'll get round to Thomas Cromwell. Thomas Cromwell, Henry VIII's minister, is the hero. He's at the centre of court affairs in the very busy decade of the 1530s, when he's Henry's right-hand man. But I take you back to his early life. Thomas Cromwell's background for a courtier was very unusual. He was born in Putney. His father, Walter, was a brewer and a blacksmith. Around about 15 years old, Thomas Cromwell ran away from home, crossed the Channel, joined the French army, then began on a series of adventures. They took him all over Europe. He came back to England in his late 20s, went into the service of Cardinal Wolsey, and from there transferred into the King's service and made the most amazing career, rising from his beginnings in the blacksmith's yard to be Earl of Essex.
One of the great joys in this selection is the number of authors from around the world, giving you an insight into the literary gems of Australia, Canada, Guyana, India, Jamaica, Malaysia, Nigeria, Pakistan, Sierra Leone, South Africa, Trinidad and Tobago, and, of course, the UK. Anuk Arudprakasam taught me about the lasting legacy of the Sri Lankan Civil War when we discussed his 2021 novel, A Passage North, and gave me an education on how the country was divided in both suffering and psyche.
What really makes him take the journey is a kind of guilt, because Krishan, the main character, is Tamil and he's from the Northeast, but he's grown up in the south of the country, in Colombo, where he's been relatively unscarred by the violence that took place at the end of the war. And so there's this kind of shame that he's been dealing with before the novel takes place. He was a PhD student in India while the war was taking place, while the final 2 years and all the violence and all the killing that involved was happening. And it leads him to leave his studies, to return to Sri Lanka, to work as a social worker, which is how he meets Rani. And so there's this constant sense of how fortunate he is. And I think that guilt plays an important role in making him go to the journey, but it's also a recurring theme throughout the text.
Alternatively, why not go for something homegrown in Scotland with a heartbreaking semi-autobiographical Shuggie Baines, the story of a young man who is torn between seeking out his own life and supporting his loving but alcoholic mother. Red had the great privilege of talking to the book's author, Douglas Stewart, when he won the Booker Prize in 2020.
Shuggie Bain is actually a portrait of the Bain family who are living in 1980s Glasgow. It is a love story at its heart, but it is the love story that looks at how children can have a very unconditional, tenacious love for parents who are a little bit flawed or who are suffering with addiction. We follow the mother of the family, Agnes Bain, who is a very beautiful, driven, ambitious, but a little bit proud and a little bit vain mother. And as her marriage is starting to come apart, she finds herself slipping into alcoholism. At the beginning of the book, everyone sort of thinks of Agnes as being too much. She is too much, she's exhausting. But actually, it's not that Agnes is too much, it's that the world around her is not enough. And so after she is sort of abandoned by her husband in a coal mining town that is similarly being shut down by the Thatcher government, she starts to slide into her addiction. And it is her three children, Catherine, Leek, and then the baby of the family, Shuggie, who stay by her side and try to save their mother from herself.
Whatever your taste, there is something for everyone. Time to dive in and explore the best poetry and prose that the Commonwealth has offered over the last 70 years. To discover the full list of books for the Big Jubilee Read, go to thereadingagency.org.uk. And if you're setting yourself the challenge of reading the entire collection, a good number of these books are available from the RNIB Library. Just go to www.rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Thanks, Hannah. Now it's back to Sarah, Duchess of York, for the books of her life.
Sarah, was there a book that you've read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Oh, you're so good, Red, to ask me that. Now, I'm wondering, because I'm so old, probably anyone listening won't remember this, but there was Walter Farley, and Walter Farley wrote the most beautiful little book called Little Black the Pony. And I was just very much obsessed with ponies and riding at that age. And it was a great book for me. It travelled everywhere with me. In fact, Red, the pony that Little Black's problem was Little Black suddenly got the little boy grow up and got a bigger pony. And the pony was called Red, would you believe? But it's very important to me because I remember it so well. And did it kick me into my authoring? I wonder, because, of course, there was Jill's Gymkhana, Ruby Ferguson, and all of those books. So I think in Lady Margaret, in Her Heart for Compass, we do notice that she rides her horses a lot, and I'm wondering whether I think it might be all tied in.
Unfortunately, Little Black, a Pony, by Walter Farley, isn't available in audio. But here's a clip that we found on YouTube.
When I was little, I had a pony. I called him Little Black. He was my very, very good friend. The two of us went all over the farm. We had fun. We went to see other horses. We saw Big Red. My, that horse could run. Then one day I said, Little Black, I would like to try to ride Big Red. So I went to the barn. I looked at Big Red. Could I ride this horse? Could I ride this big horse? I could. I could ride Big Red. It was fun. All my friends stopped to look at me. I went by Little Black, but he would not look at me. Soon, I began to jump Big Red. This horse could do everything. He jumped and jumped. But when I went by Little Black, his head was down. He looked sad.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I actually love Little Women. I mean, I really do love the Little Women book. I think it's a beautiful, beautiful read. I'm mad about Jane Austen and all of the Jane Austen books because it takes me in. And I do think that Jane Austen is another inspiration for my own writing now. Georgette Heyer, I love all of those period pieces. That's what I like on a rainy day.
And if I had to make you choose just one to pop into your bag, which one would you take?
Jane Eyre, the school, Lowood House, and then the fire, and then the gloom, and then eventually she wins through. I mean, oh, it's too good.
Hitherto I have recorded in detail the events of my insignificant existence. To the first 10 years of my life, I have given almost as many chapters. But this is not to be a regular autobiography. I'm only bound to invoke memory where I know her responses will possess some degree of interest. Therefore, I now pass a space of 8 years almost in silence. A few lines only are necessary to keep up the links of connection. When the typhus fever had fulfilled its mission of devastation at Lowood, it gradually disappeared from thence. But not till its virulence and the number of its victims had drawn public attention on the school. Inquiry was made into the origin of the scourge, and by degrees various facts came out which excited public indignation in a high degree. The unhealthy nature of the site, the quantity and quality of the children's food, the brackish, fetid water used in its preparation, the pupils' wretched clothing and accommodations, all these things were discovered, and the discovery produced a result mortifying to Mr. Brocklehurst, but beneficial to the institution.
Lucy Scott narrating Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Well, now, it depends whether Tom Bradbury is their bag or not. Tom Bradbury's written Triple Cross, and that is a really meaty read. I mean, he has thrown himself into his thrillers, but that's quite a recent one if you've got that, because I find that fascinating. I like his work a lot. I mean, but I like Ken Follett and Geoffrey Archer, so I get a lot of my inspiration from many different books. I mean, Pillars of the Earth, Ken Follett, you can put that in if that's recent, or you can put in Geoffrey Archer's latest, the Clifton series, I love. It depends what kind of book you want. I'm a seriously prolific reader. I have to be a prolific reader.
Now Kate Henderson was sure. She had seen the clean-shaven man with faded jeans, olive t-shirt and fawn trainers while she waited in line at the butcher's shop on the square. And the woman with dark glasses, a lime sundress, and what looked like a blue Chloe handbag, had been paying for parking just in front of them when they arrived in the centre of town an hour ago. Kate put down the giant aubergines she was about to buy, nodded regretfully at the wizened Frenchman behind the trestle table, and wandered nonchalantly back along the market stalls until she was standing beneath the entrance to the Grand Cathedral, the Église Notre-Dame de Bergerac.
Juliet Aubrey narrating Triple Cross by Tom Bradby, which is available commercially.
Well, Sarah Ferguson, Duchess of York, thank you so much for coming onto the show and sharing insights into her heart as the compass and into your own obvious joy of reading with the Read On listeners. And I hope you'll come back onto the show in years to come to discuss your novels to come.
Oh, you're so kind. It's just an absolute joy to hear the calming and lovely voice of you, Red. Thank you.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at RedSale, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week. Enjoy this historic Platinum Jubilee weekend and try and find some time to read on.